Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of whether the tide of battle in Syria is turning in favor of the Assad dictatorship and what that might have to do with talks soon to take place brokered by Russia and the United States. Chris Tensing, an Arabic-speaking specialist on Syria who is the Executive Director of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor of the Middle East Report, joins us to discuss recent changes on both the battlefield and in the diplomatic arena. Then we will speak with Princeton historian Julian Salazar about his article at CNN, What Happened to Obama's Promise, and discuss the criticism of the president coming from his disillusioned supporters on the left who expected a transformational president instead of a transactional one. We will examine whether reform is possible in Washington and what Obama could and should do to motivate his spiritless supporters to vote in 2014. Then finally, we look into the power of the telecom oligarchs in the new Gilded Age, who are the contemporary equivalent of the railroad barons, but exert unprecedented influence over us as the gatekeepers of news and information. Susan Crawford, who served as Special Assistant to President Obama for Science, Technology, and Innovation Policy, and is the author of the new book Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age, joins us to talk about how America, where the Internet revolution began, is slipping further and further behind as Americans get gouged by monopolies who charge more and more for less and less service. Joining us now is Chris Tensing, who is an Arabic-speaking specialist on Syria. He's the Executive Director of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor of the Middle East Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Tensing.
Thank you.
And clearly this battle for this key town in Syria seems to be a bellwether for this long and painful civil war, and indications are that the Assad's may turn the tide of battle in their favor with the help of Hezbollah. And of course, we know that Iran and Russia have been doubling down in supplying arms. How critical do you think this battle is?
Well, I think it's important to note that no matter if the regime is able to prevail in this particular battle and win this particular ground back from the rebels, it is extremely unlikely that the Syrian regime is ever going to exercise full control over the entire territory of the country of Syria in the way that it did before the rebellion broke out. So these battlefield advances that are being reported are about its relative position vis-a-vis the rebellion. The overall picture is still, I think, a balance of weakness, with neither side able to win definitively or decisively, and for the time being, at least, the various international powers that are sending aid to the combatant parties not willing to send aid that would tip the scales decisively in the favor of either side.
So there's also conflicting reports that support the notion that maybe in the long run, if this is a short-term victory for the Assads and for Hezbollah, in the long run, there are indications that the Assads and the Alawites are maybe preparing for a kind of enclave, a partition of the country along the northwestern coast of Syria, the traditional Alawite homeland, and which, of course, right in the middle of that is the Russian naval base of Tartus.
Yeah, I'm skeptical of that line of analysis because it goes against, you know, everything, every ideological stance that the Ba'athist regimes in Syria have always taken. It's a mistake to characterize the Syrian regime as an Alawi regime or to imply that the Assad family is somehow recognized and hailed as the leader of the Alawi community. That's not the case. There are lots of Alawis in Syria who loathe the regime just as much as anyone else. The problem is that, in large part because of the regime's own divide-and-rule policies over the several decades, not to speak of during the Civil War itself, that sectarian fears have been so whipped up that for a lot of Alawis, they sort of feel trapped, that even though they loathe the regime and do not consider it to be their representative in any way, they fear that if the regime falls, they would be held collectively responsible and collectively guilty for the regime's many crimes over the years. And that is a fear that the regime has has willfully stoked and one that it knows plays to its advantage. So I do think that probably the regime's reported successes on the battlefield are about strengthening its negotiating position vis-a-vis the rebels and vis-a-vis the international community. They see perhaps an opportunity now to get something at the negotiation table, which is more than negotiating the terms of their own demise and, you know, would have been their literally their own physical demise until recently, perhaps.
And of course, Chris Tunsing, an Arabic-speaking specialist on Syria, who is executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor of the Middle East Report. These talks, of course, are the result of Secretary of State Kerry's trip to Russia. And for the longest time, it appeared that the U.S. had castigated both China and Russia for vetoing UN resolutions and didn't seem to want to talk to the Russians. Those days seem to be over. Is that what you're referring to in terms of what the Assad see as an opening for them in terms of being in a better position? So that would assume that these talks are going to happen. And I guess my first question is it likely that the Assads would sit down with the rebels? These people hate each other in ways that we can't even comprehend.
That's the $60,000 question, and I think you're entirely right that the other thing that seems to have changed in the big picture, besides these, what seems to be, at least relatively speaking, a turning of the military tide in Syria, is the stance of Russia. And until last week, Russia seemed to be immovable in its staunch support for Syrian regime, whatever the Syrian regime's position was. Now, it seems that by dint of this U.S.-Russian announcement of shared support for political talks, which came out of Kerry's trip, that, you know, one would assume that Russia is prepared to exert some pressure on Assad to come to the negotiating table. But that's the other $60,000 question, whether Russia, in fact, is prepared to do that and will do that, because that would probably be necessary. And, you know, another thing that could be happening as a result of what's happening on the battlefield is that the regime is less willing to negotiate as opposed to more. It's hard to say what's going on in their minds, of course.
Well, of course, Putin, after he'd met with Kerry, met with the Israeli Prime Minister, and apparently it was a pretty contentious meeting. And subsequent to that, we've learned that the Russians are supplying some advanced ground-to-ground missiles, which are anti-ship missiles, which may well be intended to keep the Israeli Navy at bay. So what do you think went on in those talks? And obviously, you'd have to add to this the fact that recently Israel struck at the heart of the Assad regime at the airport, allegedly stopping missiles from getting to Hezbollah. But they also seem to have struck Republican Guard positions right on the very doorstep where the president's palace is on top of Mount Kaisun.
Right. And the coincidence of all these events is certainly interesting and certainly tempts one to make some connection between them. And they may not be connected, but it is certainly tempting to think that the Israeli strikes and Israel's were intended as some kind of prod to the United States to do something, quote-unquote, and that the U.S.-Russian initiative is therefore a way of trying to contain this crisis, to try and stop it from escalating further militarily, certainly not spiraling into a multi-front regional war, and therefore to sort of get Israel to cool its jets a little bit, if you'll pardon the metaphor.
Well, it seems to me that both the Israelis and the Syrians may be playing some kind of brinksmanship here to test the other side. The fact that Israel has struck twice now deep inside Syria and done serious damage, and Syria has not retaliated, would indicate something, I imagine. And then conversely, the fact that it looks as though Syria may have been behind the Assads, that is, may have been behind a very limited use of chemical weapons to test Western resolve and reaction. And also the bombing inside of Turkey, where a bunch of civilians were killed on Turkish territory. That might have been, well, another example of the Assads testing Turkey's resolve. In both cases, Turkey seems to have rolled over, and the White House rolled over on their red line.
Yes, I mean, as far as the chemical weapons, it's still not apparent how much illicit substances were used and by whom. But I do think that there is, as you said, some testing of boundaries going on. And certainly the decision of Syria not to retaliate to the Israeli strikes, as it did not retaliate in 2007 when Israel struck its supposed nuclear research facility, is clearly intentional and calibrated as a way of basically declining to be provoked into some kind of confrontation that Syria would lose, the Syrian regime would definitely lose. And Hezbollah figures into that as well, because one thing that Israel could do in counter-retaliation, if you will, if Syria were to retaliate for strikes, it would be to hit Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Well, there is, apparently. I've talked to some strategists who are following what's going on in the neighborhood, both in terms of the immediate war and the extent to which it's a surrogate war with outside players. And I think it was Aram Nagezian at the Center for Strategic and International Studies who suggested that it's very tempting for Israel now, with Hezbollah being involved in Syria, and they're apparently in the midst of this key battle that's going on now. There's a lot of Hezbollah fighters in there, that it may be tempting for Israel to do a flanking movement from the Golan Heights, as because Hezbollah is otherwise diverted in fighting in Syria. Do you think that's a possibility? I mean, it would change the whole calculus, surely, and it'd make it an Arab-Israeli war as opposed to an intra-Arab war, a civil war.
Correct. And I do think that there is a danger that some in the Israeli establishment would press for such an opportunistic use of this crisis. Since the 2006 war, both people in Israel and pro-Israel commentators here in the West have been saying that round two, so-called round two of the 2006 war, was virtually inevitable. But the fact that Hezbollah fought the Israeli army to a standstill on the ground, and that its entire arsenal of rockets and so on was not destroyed and has subsequently been replenished, meant that it was just a matter of time before Israel would seek to strike Hezbollah again with comparable force. And it could very well be that some in Israel see this crisis in Syria as an opportunity to deal Hezbollah a more severe blow than was dealt in 2006. And indeed, that would change the dynamics of the Syria crisis completely, turning it into an Arab-Israeli conflict. There already has been, as a result of the Israeli airstrikes, some effect to which the rebels in Syria are cast as objectively pro-Israel, quote-unquote. And that, of course, is assumed to redound to their discredit, not to their benefit politically, and to the regime's benefit politically within Syria and within the larger Arab world. And certainly if there were to be a bigger war that were to break out, and especially if Israel were seen to have a hand in provoking it, that one could expect the Syrian regime to benefit at least temporarily politically from that. And so that, I think, also figures into the Syrian regime's calculations here.
But who in the world would believe that the al-Nusra Front, this al-Qaeda-affiliated group, is in any way less than hostile towards Israel? And indeed, my understanding is amongst the Free Syrian Army and the more secular and the ones that started this revolution, as opposed to those who came in and took advantage of it, like al-Qaeda, if that's indeed the way to describe the al-Nusra people, is that they've always thought that the Assads were too cozy with the Israelis. In other words, if anything, the rebels are more anti-Israel than the Assad regime.
That may well be true, and that's a huge irony of the situation. But I don't think it would stop the Syrian regime from trying to cast the situation in classic Arab-Israeli terms, sure, should it come to that.
Well, they've already done that at any rate and tried that. Every time Israel struck, they've blamed it on the rebels. So Chris Tensing, again, an Arabic-speaking specialist on Syria, who's the executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor of the Middle East Report. What explains the fact that early in this war, both Hillary Clinton and the Turks in particular thought this would be a cakewalk and that Assad would fall just as Mubarak and the other relics of Arab dictatorships did in the Arab Spring? Something's obviously changed now, and they changed the Turkish calculus because the prime minister was at the White House, and he hasn't responded against the bombing inside Turkey, which presumably came from the Assad. So have they just recalibrated what's going on? And is because Hillary Clinton went public with this confident idea that Assad would fall, has that basically hamstrung Obama? Has that tied his hands?
Well, I think that the U.S. and Turkey and other governments made an analytical error, which has been made by a lot of independent analysts as well, and been something that's been hard for a lot of outsiders to understand, which is that the Syrian regime, for all of its undoubted depredations over the years and its undoubted brutal authoritarian rule that Syrians of all backgrounds suffer from equally, does have a base, a political and social base, that has remained resilient to a large degree, even after this last 2 years of horrible fighting. And the reasons for that are complicated. They are partly related to the way that the regime has stirred up sectarian fears over the years. They're partly related to the regime's divide and rule tactics. They're partly related to the vicious sectarian behavior on the part of some of the rebel groups and the atrocities that rebel groups have committed, which have given credence to the fear that Alawis, for example, would be held collectively guilty for the crimes of the Assad regime should that regime fall and a successor regime come to power. But so the fears explain part of it. There is also the fact there is a business elite in Syria that has, for the most part, stuck with the regime, in part because it's basically complicit in a lot of what the regime has done over the years and would rise and fall with the regime. So there is this political base that the regime has managed to hold on to. And so it's not like Egypt or Tunisia, where you really did have a situation where a divided regime with significant internal cracks was facing basically a heterogeneous, unified population. In Syria, the opposite has been true, where you have basically a coherent and unified regime without significant cracks that has faced a quite heterogeneous and divided population.
Well, Chris Tensing, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Chris Tensing, who's an Arabic-speaking specialist on Syria, who is the executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor of the Middle East Report. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about what happened to Obama's reform agenda. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. His most recent books include Jimmy Carter, Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, and his latest is Governing America, The Revival of Political History. He has an article at CNN, What Happened to Obama's Promise? Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
And your article indicates that, I guess, a sort of turning point. You're using Jon Stewart's Daily Show to indicate how a very, very effective and powerful spokesperson, I wouldn't say necessarily for Democrats, he's actually, his program is more popular with the younger demographics. That's how they get their news, from a satirical program that satirizes the news. But I take it you feel that the fact that he's expressed disappointment in Obama, that might well signal something restive is going on, shall we say?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's many Democrats or supporters of President Obama who, you know, don't believe that a lot of the scandal discussion going on equal Watergate. But I think there's a level of frustration that this taps into, that the president has basically, you know, practiced politics that is more ordinary or more normal than many were hoping for when he came into office. And I think Stewart expressed a little of this sentiment in one of his clips where, you know, he's showing pictures of Bill O'Reilly launching attacks on the president, you know, based on things that are far from fact, and then playing the IRS story and just expressing some frustration with what's happened to this president.
Well, of course, the president recently did, I mean, he's being criticized, of course, that instead of being the transformational president that his rhetoric in 2008 suggested he would be, he's become a transactional president. But as you point out in your article at CNN, what happened to Obama's promise, Julian Zelizer, is that, you know, he essentially inherited a mess and you know, this is how it is. He, when you inherit all these problems of a government that have not gone away, you know, you're pretty much stuck with trying to deal with what can be done as opposed to what should be done. Am I paraphrasing you correctly?
That's true. You know, he had so many policy problems, like many presidents before him. You know, he made a decision that he's going to focus on issues where he could gain some traction, where he can make some progress, whereas political reform, government reform is extremely difficult, and it often doesn't generate, you know, broad support, but generates a lot of intense opposition. He also has faced a very polarized Congress, and so I think that, too, has created a disincentive for him to deal with things like campaign finance reform and to instead, you know, try to use the muscle that he has through the existing system rather than try to eliminate it. But it moved him very far away from some of the insights he started with about how our political system works and the kinds of outcomes it inevitably leads to.
Well, I suppose if you needed an example of that argument, Julian Zelizer, there's nothing more, I think, accurate an example than what just happened with gun control. The president clearly, and the Democrats obviously didn't want to touch gun control. They thought it was a losing proposition. But the president was so, I believe, personally outraged by what happened in Newtown, Connecticut with their school children, young school children being massacred, as was obviously a lot of Americans as well. And against all political advice, he weighed in and tried to do something. And guess what? He failed.
Right. But there he faced two of the issues he campaigned on, one, filibusters and the need to reform the filibuster system, and two, campaign finance and the power of interest groups. And when he decided to go out on a limb and take on this issue, both of those problems came back to haunt him. Two problems he's essentially ignored, and in some ways with campaign finance exacerbated since becoming president. You know, the gun rights movement with all its various interest groups mounted a very powerful lobby, not just the NRA, but even smaller groups, and it was hard to get a 60-vote majority, supermajority in the Senate. And so there are the structural problems that he's very aware of, but decided to put on the back burner, came back to haunt him. And, I mean, that's the kind of trade-off that can be very damaging over the long run and leave us in a system that's constantly broken.
And again, I'm speaking with Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's the author of Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and he has an article at CNN, What Happened to Obama's Promise. So why not take on filibuster reform on day one? I mean, he can do the math.
Yeah. I mean, there were many Democrats who thought that he should and realized the importance of this particular procedure because it creates such an enormous barrier in the Senate to any piece of legislation. The White House gave strong signals to Senate Democrats that that's not something they wanted to do. It would be a heated battle. It would be a tough battle. It could be as tough, if not tougher, than health care. And as we said a few minutes ago, he decided if he's going to do that, he was going to do it on a area of concrete policy. You know, in the first term on health care, second term on fighting these budget battles with the Republicans. But that left that question of filibuster reform when he was at his strongest. That's the moment you can do something like this, get the Senate to move on this. It put it to the side. Many people thought in 2009 that's really what he should have started with, again, it's hard. In retrospect, he was dealing with a crisis, but it does have big consequences that we don't change the system.
But it has big consequences for him as the head of the executive branch. He's not getting his appointments through. They're not getting passed. He puts up the nominations and they filibuster almost everybody, particularly his judicial nominees. And now we have a judiciary that has enormous numbers of vacancies, including the key court, which is right below the Supreme Court, that he recently tried to get an appointment to. And for the second time, she was turned down, even though she's manifestly qualified. So it seems to me that this has to be very personal for him because, you know, the D.C. Court of Appeals is such a key court. It, not only does it feed the Supreme Court the important cases, it also tends to feed the justices who end up on the Supreme Court. And that court, because of its Republican majority, recently ruled against him in the only recourse he has against the filibuster, which is recess appointments. And now they're trying to make his recess appointments invalid. So what does it take to rile up this president?
Well, I don't know. I think that's where some of the frustration comes in. I think you are correct. One of the problems has come with appointments and an incredibly slow, grinding, and really dysfunctional appointment process that we have right now, leaving huge gaps in the judiciary and other parts of the executive branch. And two is just with legislation. It's not only bills that fail or don't get the 60 votes needed, it's bills that aren't even tried because the White House just looks at the numbers and says we'll never get that far. And so that should frustrate a president. It should certainly anger someone who is as, on top of how politics works as this president, but it doesn't. And this has been, part of how we'll remember his presidency. And this has nothing to do with the whole Homeland Security and AP reporters issue, which I think is a different kind of challenge. But certainly on these procedural questions, he has not made them a priority.
So what do you make then, Julian Zelizer, of these reports that Obama has told some of his aides privately that he'd like to go Bullworth? And that's a reference to a movie starring Warren Beatty where a senator sort of goes off the deep end and starts telling the truth and is goes out of character, or at least in terms of the way Washington is, throws caution to the wind and starts telling the truth. Do you think there's anything to that?
I don't think it's going to happen, and maybe he talks about it, but I'm not sure exactly what he means by that. If he's talking about Bullworth, wasn't just about his opponents, the senator in that movie. It was about how the whole political system works. So Warren Beatty, plays this character who's brutally honest about campaign finance, who's brutally honest about the power of money in politics. It would be surprising to see President Obama talk about that, but he himself has been, totally invested in that system. He abandoned the Watergate era campaign finance reforms. He accepted the assistance of super PACs in 2012. So maybe he would pull a Bullworth on that front. And I don't know if he's talking about that or he's talking about his opposition, the Republicans. But given who we've had in office these years, I just don't think that's who we're going to see. He's a very cool caution someone who is not really interested in taking those kinds of risks.
Well, it seems to me, though, that he did have an opportunity not so much to go Bullworth, but at least to both deal with this burgeoning scandal over the IRS and I think redirect it in a way that would have been positive for all Americans, and that is to point out that the reason that the IRS in this Cincinnati office put forth these terms like Tea Party and Patriot was to flag the blizzard of applications that they were getting that were just pouring in because of the Citizens United decision under this rubric called the 501c4, which is supposed to be a tax-exempt instrument used for charity, for social welfare is the actual that's the actual category in the IRS, social welfare. And it seems to me that was a great opportunity to talk about the absurdity of these flagrantly political organizations being getting tax exemption as social welfare charities. You know, instead of doing a kind of mea culpa, which the Republicans, of course, don't care about and not going to work. I mean, that's just my personal opinion. How does it strike you?
It's true. I don't think he wants to do that, though. I mean, the use of these tax-exempt organizations is on both sides of the aisle, and certainly Democrats have benefited as well. So if he wanted to pull a Bullworth, you're right. That was a moment to say, hey, the scandal isn't, you know, flagging the Tea Party in Cincinnati. It's simply the entire system we have that's fueling this kind of campaign finance. But he was notably silent on that. There's been people writing about it. That's not the kind of issue he wants to take on. I think ultimately he has concluded, for whatever reason, he would, you know, rather build a Democratic Party that in his mind can thrive in this campaign finance system rather than to try to transform the campaign finance system, which could bring certain risks to him and to the Democrats. That's at least his calculation.
But on the other phony scandal, the Benghazi one, that was essentially the Fox News had been beating the drum since 9/11 last year when this tragic incident took place that took the lives of four Americans. They've been beating the drum. Recently, ABC ran with a story that was fed to them by the Republicans, and was also fed to the Evening Standard, that turns out in retrospect that there is whether or not these White House emails were doctored or whether they were selectively edited, apparently there is a real discrepancy in what Jonathan Carl of ABC put out and what later Jake Tapper of CNN put out. The less edited version is much less incriminating than the original one that was leaked. So there it is that they've been able to breathe life into this phony scandal. And Obama is not standing up for the fact that his own White House emails from the National Security Council are being manipulated.
Yes. I there are three issues. There's the IRS issue, which brings with it the questions you raised about tax-exempt organizations and possibly someone who wasn't making smart decisions. There's the Benghazi, which has really been a drummed-up scandal that has not generated much interest other than from the right wing, but it's allowed them to keep something alive, to keep a story in right-wing circles and keep people interested. But really, the kind of press treatment we've seen on it has often been quite stunning. And this final story of the AP, I don't think that's a scandal so much as a discussion of policy. And I think it fits in general with the kind of national security policies that the administration's embraced, often closer to the previous administration than Obama supporters wanted. And there's no scandal there. I think really what we're seeing is just a revelation of the kind of tactics that are being used. So there's three different issues. I think the politics are all different. But I think regardless of these stories, they've all tapped into some sense that the presidency's lost some of where he started or what he started with.
Well, just in closing, Julian Zelizer, just back to your article at CNN, what happened to Obama's promise and how you mentioned John Stewart on The Daily Show going after the president and expressing a frustration that many liberals and progressives clearly share and have shared for some time in this country. If they don't show up in the midterms, then it's going to be 2010 all over. I mean, what was striking about the midterms, and it apparently is a convention in American politics, that Obama was elected, I think, on about 140 million votes, and he swept in with a trifecta, the House, the Senate, and the White House in 2008. 2 years later, thanks to Karl Rove and a lot of serious money and a lot of good organization, the Republicans were able to take back the House, and only 75 million Americans voted. So there's the discrepancy. Is Obama going to campaign in 2014? Is he going to get these people out, or are the disillusioned liberals not going to show up, and therefore the Republicans will take the Senate as well as the House?
Well, I think he will campaign, and I think he's well aware after 2010 that he needs as strong a Congress as possible, and so he wants to at least diminish or dampen the kinds of losses that the Democrats face. You know, will Democrats show up? It's hard. You know, it's hard enough in presidential campaigns, but the younger segment, the Obama coalition, doesn't really show up in midterms. They didn't in 2010, and it's going to be very hard to excite them this coming round, especially if there's some tiring that's going on of the administration in general. So it's a big risk, and it could certainly shape the last 2 years where the president will still be facing these kinds of budget battles that we've seen over the past.
Well, Julian Zelizer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. His most recent books include Jimmy Carter, Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, and his latest book is Governing America, The Revival of Political History. He has an article at CNN, What Happened to Obama's Promise? We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the telecom oligarchs in the new Gilded Age. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Susan Crawford, who's a professor of law at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University and a regular contributor to Bloomberg View and Wired. She served as special assistant to the president for science, technology, and innovation policy during 2009 and co-led the FCC transition team between the Bush and Obama administrations. Susan Crawford is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, where she leads the Institute's work on making high-speed internet access a universal, affordable resource for all, and is a member of Mayor Michael Bloomberg's Advisory Council on Technology and Innovation. Susan Crawford is a visiting professor at Harvard Law School and a visiting Stanton professor of the First Amendment at Harvard's Kennedy School. And her latest book just out is Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the Gilded Age. Welcome to Background Briefing, Susan Crawford.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I see you don't hedge your bets on the Gilded Age. We're not talking about McKinley here. We're talking about the present, right?
Yes, I'm talking about the new Gilded Age, an era in which Brian Roberts, the CEO of Comcast, makes 1,000 times as much as the average Comcast employee. And it's an age of plutocrats and enormous oligopolies that dominate, particularly in the media industry in the United States.
Well, I'm speaking to you literally from across the street to Universal Studios, which was just gobbled up by the Roberts.
I thought Universal Studios, oh, that's right. They're part of the NBCU megalopolis. You know, it's so large, it's very hard to keep together which pieces go where.
Well, but they promised the FCC more diversity, et cetera, better service. And as soon as they got the go-ahead, they went ahead and bought more companies and consolidated. I mean, that's my understanding.
Yes, NBCU Comcast is an enormous concern, and when it comes to the wires that they sell, they cover 50 million American households, 45% of the American population, so it's really very large.
But there's more at play here than just these new monopolies essentially cornering the market on the information age and giving diminishing service at higher cost to their consumers. This also surely affects America's overall competitiveness. The high-speed internet is one of the greatest tools that could revolutionize medical care and education. The Japanese, the Koreans, the French, everybody is jumping on the bandwagon, and it's proven to be an extraordinary economic resource if it's used for the public good. So what happened here? We invented the internet, for God's sake.
Yes, we invented it, and for the first generation of internet innovation, absolutely the United States led the way. But between the time that we came up with the idea and now, there's been enormous consolidation and deregulation of the on-ramps that give us access to the Internet. So to boil down the whole story, for more than 80% of Americans, your only choice for a truly world-class high-speed Internet access connection is your local cable monopoly. And the cable companies long ago divided up the country. So, you know, they centralized their activities and pulled together their systems. So in your, if you're in Boston, that's Comcast territory. Other Time Warner Cable is another enormous cable company, second to Comcast, that controls its own cities. This is a real drag, as you indicate, on our global competitiveness because we pay more per megabit of Internet access than almost every other developed country in the world. Only Mexico, Chile, Greece, and New Zealand are more expensive than we are.
And the service is getting worse and worse. I mean, they have the monopoly, they bundle everything, they give you what's often referred to as the poverty of choice, where you can channel surf all day and not find anything. I mean, this is the part of it that's extraordinary, is that we essentially are so far behind the rest of the world, including France, where I believe it's you get, what, 10 times the speed for one quarter of the price?
Yeah, somebody living in the city of Paris has multiple choices for very high-speed connections at about $35, $40 a month. That's unthinkable in the United States. Now, the cable actors on their side would say, no, no, we're improving service because you can have, for the richest Americans, you can pay through the nose 400 megabit per second download services and many, many channels of content. Now, the problem with this service is that it's not symmetrical. Los Angeles is a publishing town, and you'll want the ability to upload bits to actually publish as well as passively receive. And when it comes to uploading capacity, cable is far second place to what the world standard is now, which is fiber optic connections. Now, Verizon began building out fiber optic, including in some parts of L.A., but in March 2010 announced that it wasn't going to be expanding its Fios services. So bottom line, the cable actors Comcast and Time Warner face competition from Verizon in only very small slices of their territory. 15% of Comcast territory overlaps with Verizon, and 11% of Time Warner Cable's territory. So in the rest of their enormous footprints, they face no competition, and it is entirely within their discretion what services they're going to sell and how good they're going to be and whether they're going to allow us to compete as a nation.
So in other words, Verizon made a quantum leap forward in quality for their consumers, and then they decided, because of their monopolistic power, that they didn't need to invest any more money, that they could give substandard service.
Well, Verizon saw the writing on the wall, which is that it's much cheaper to upgrade the cable plant to provide these 100 megabit per second download speeds than it is to rip up copper from the streets, Verizon's copper, and replace that with fiber. And they had another whole business available to them, which was wireless. So Verizon saw higher margins on the wireless side of their business and decided to devote their attention there and to back off entirely from expanding their fiber operations in America. In effect, they ceded the territory to the cable companies. So it's a sort of a you take wires, we'll take wireless arrangement between AT&T and Verizon on the one hand, who are almost entirely focused on wireless, and Time Warner Cable and Comcast on the other, who control the wired marketplace in America.
Again, I'm speaking with Susan Crawford, a professor of law at the Benjamin Cardoza School of Law at Yeshiva University, and a visiting professor at Harvard Law School, and a visiting Stanton professor of the First Amendment at Harvard's Kennedy School. Her latest book is Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the Gilded Age. And your book makes it clear that the railroad barons of today run these cable companies. And as bad as it is that they have monopolistic power, they can almost write their own checks in terms of what they charge, and they don't obviously care about what kind of service they provide. When they are faced with competition, for example, the city of Chattanooga, as a municipality, they have it as a utility, high-speed internet access, and it's extraordinary. I think it's the fastest in the country. But other cities and states that have tried that have been proactively sued by Verizon and other of these big telecom monopolies.
Yes, in 19 states in the United States, the incumbents have managed to erect barriers to cities who want to make this decision for themselves. Now, there's some great exceptions to this right in your own backyard. Santa Monica has built its own municipal fiber network serving right now city buildings and many businesses in Santa Monica at a reasonable rate. And they find that this drives economic development, that people wanting to rent, businesses wanting to come to Santa Monica, ask first about fiber access before almost any other attribute of a business building. And this has really been a bright light for Santa Monica, and I'm hoping that that same model can be replicated in other cities across the country.
Well, apparently the state of Georgia sued, did they not, recently against... Well, Georgia House of Representatives voted down a proposal that would have prevented cities from investing in their own internet access networks. I take it the proposal that they voted down was coming from the telecom monopolies.
Absolutely. Yeah, they were essentially saying that if anybody in a city in Georgia had access to a private provider's speeds of 3 megabits per second or more, that the city could do nothing to build its own network. And that was so apparently protecting the incumbent status quo that city managers and lots of groups in Georgia rose up and said, forget it, we can't possibly let this legislation go through. I see this as a turning point, really. I think it's going to be useful to us in tussles in other state legislatures. The bigger point is that where private monopolies have emerged, often the city has to use its control over its rights of way to just make sure that its citizens are served by reasonably priced, fairly available access. This is just like electricity or water or sewage. It's just like the street grid. It's an input into everything the city wants to accomplish.
And Susan Crawford, you served as a special assistant to the President for Science, Technology, and Innovation Policy during 2009 and co-led the FCC transition team between the Bush and Obama administrations. And clearly, the FCC has the ability to oversee and be the advocate for the public. And it seems that over the years, there's been a revolving door with a lot of people becoming commissioners and then ending up working for the cable companies. And under Michael Powell, he basically gave away the store. And there are things that, for example, the FCC could do about Citizens United, which is an incredibly corrosive decision that has changed our politics and basically enabled the very oligarchs that you write about in your new book, Captive Audience, the Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the Gilded Age. They could actually force the broadcasters to reveal the source of those who are paying for these political commercials, which are the way that our politics are transacted via television commercials. That's what happens. You know, the candidates, the congressmen, the senators raise money from special interests and then they turn it over to the television monopolies. And that's how they get reelected. So what's happening at the FCC? That's a long-winded question, but that's the bottom line.
Well, I can only take on one problem at once, and Citizens United is obviously at the heart of all of these issues. But what I'm focused on is what we can do to ensure reasonably priced, ubiquitous, very high-speed, globally competitive access for everybody in America. And there, the FCC has been quite effective in at least talking about the necessity for very high-capacity networks in America. Julius Genachowski, the outgoing FCC chairman, made a number of speeches mentioning the importance of gigabit networks. Where they haven't been quite as effective is making the policy changes that would be needed to keep our existing incumbents out of control, I mean, not allow them to block the creation of competitive fiber networks that would serve Americans. And there's certainly much more to be done on this score. We're now waiting for the new FCC chairman to arrive, and the jury's out. We'll see what he accomplishes when he comes in.
Well, you were suggested by a number of people. There was a sort of a spontaneous campaign to put your name forward, wasn't there, for that job?
Yeah, I was very honored by that campaign. I think Tom Wheeler, the one who was chosen by the president, is more than qualified for the position, and I'm delighted to know that there's someone coming in who has such a backbone and is a very smart guy. My role in all this is just to make sure that the FCC lets the American public know that there's a problem. We've got a competitive problem for high-speed internet access in America, and that creates two very important digital divides. One is between people who make less money in America and rural people and the very rich people. Socioeconomic status is very highly correlated with high-speed internet access in America. So internally, we're doing is entrenching existing inequality because of our absence of policy in this area. But then as a nation, we are falling behind other countries who take this issue very seriously. South Korea has announced that everybody in the country is going to have gigabit symmetrical fiber access. That's 100 times faster than the average connection in America by 2017. And that's a goal we can't even imagine here.
Well, you have been described, Susan Crawford, as the Elizabeth Warren of the telecom world, and you've been fighting the good fight on the behalf of consumers. I was reading a very ironical piece that you wrote about the Mexican billionaire Carlos Slim Alou, who was up until a few days ago the richest man in the world. The other richest guy, of course, who just eclipsed him was Bill Gates. He controls 80% of the landlines in Mexico and 70% of the wireless market there. But you're arguing that, in a way, it's tougher here because you don't just have the one target. You've got a number of these big, entrenched, powerful, and politically connected oligopolies here in the United States.
Yeah, what's interesting about the situation in America is that these major players don't even have to agree to set prices. They can act in parallel to exclude competition quite easily by their bundling practices, by the barriers to entry that they can raise. And they are in a very comfortable place right now. I mean, one of the great benefits of being a monopolist is a quiet life. And Verizon, AT&T, Time Warner Cable, and Comcast all have quite quiet lives right now. The status quo is terrific for them. But the effect of all this behavior is very similar to what Mexico has experienced under Mr. Slim. Cherry-picking markets, charging rich customers a great deal, often leaving the poor out, and letting the state bear the burden of trying to fill the gap. It's not good for the country as a whole. We're essentially experiencing monopoly power with four monopolists coordinating their activities.
And I take it you're suggesting that this is not necessarily motivated out of malice or evil on the part of the oligopolies. It's just the way it works.
Yes, if you're a private company, this is what you try to do. You try to maximize shareholder value. And AT&T, for example, has paid out more in dividends every year of the last 13 years than it has invested in its network over the last 12 years. So when they're allocating capital, they're going to allocate it to dividends and buybacks, and they're going to keep prices up as high as they can muster them. It is not in their interest to invest in the fiber upgrade that the country needs as a whole. If AT&T had devoted half of those dividends to investing in fiber, 70 million people in America would have fiber to the home. This happens in these basic infrastructure businesses. The absolutely rational incentives of the private companies are not necessarily aligned with the interests of the country as a whole.
So given that situation, then isn't the burden on the government to step in and be the advocate for the people?
Yes, it is the role of government to stand up against the idea that might makes right. And we have a regulatory ideal in this country, and it's very pro-competition, pro-free market, pro-economic growth. It's the idea that creating a level playing field for all Americans makes possible enormous spillover effects in productivity, economic growth, social cohesion, all these things. This is why we care about clean water and public education and all these other quite expensive basic attributes of American life. For some reason, we now treat high-speed internet access like a luxury, just as the country once treated electricity as a luxury. But just like electricity, it's not. It's an input into absolutely everything we want to do, and it should be available at a reasonable price to everybody.
Well, why doesn't the White House or the Democrats or somebody, why don't they champion the idea of letting cities like Chattanooga, like Santa Monica that you mentioned, build out their own high-speed networks?
Well, it would be very disruptive to the plans of these giant companies for the White House or the administration to make a big fuss about this. So I'm not sure why they don't. I decided that my attention is better directed towards assisting cities in doing this for themselves and rolling back the state laws that get in their way and ensuring that they have the best possible information available to them as they make the choice to make sure their citizens are well served.
And the fact that today, Susan Crawford, Yahoo announced that they're buying Tumblr for $1.1 billion at the same time, vowing not to screw it up. It's a very odd business announcement, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I was Yahoo's outside privacy lawyer back in 2000 when Yahoo was the cool internet company. And I've been very sad to see Yahoo lose its edge over the last few years. And maybe their new CEO believes that this is the way to add energy and profits to the company. The jury's out. We'll see whether money can actually be made on Tumblr. As a nation, we tend to be very fond of mergers and big deals. They're sort of shiny and interesting. They're like sports events. This one may or may not help Yahoo develop the scale and sort of profit profile that it needs to continue to be successful.
Well, in closing, Susan Crawford, obviously listening to you and reading your book, Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the Gilded Age, one's left with the distinct impression that we need a Teddy Roosevelt. We need a trust buster.
Yes, we do. We need leadership. Only with FDR's involvement in electricity did the entire country get electrical service. When he came into office, 90% of farmers didn't have it. And he took on the special interests and the private trusts and made sure that it was available at a reasonable cost. Now we've got that same battle, but it's over fiber, high-speed internet access. And it will take leadership at the highest levels to ensure that the country as a whole gets it. Now, until that happens, cities can do a lot to change the equation and get people excited about the possibilities of fiber access. And we're already seeing that happen across the country.
Well, Susan Crawford, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Susan Crawford, who's a professor of law at the Benjamin Cardoza School of Law at Yeshiva University and a regular contributor to Bloomberg View and Wired. She served as special assistant to the president for science, technology, and innovation policy during 2009 and co-led the FCC transition team between the Bush and Obama administrations. Susan Crawford is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, where she leads the institute's work on making high-speed internet access a universal, affordable resource for all, and is a member of Mayor Michael Bloomberg's Advisory Council on Technology and Innovation. Susan Crawford is a visiting professor at Harvard's Law School and a visiting Stanton professor of the First Amendment at Harvard's Kennedy School. And her latest book just out is Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was